Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the last Kudzu Vine of 2008. Welcome, Tim.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, Wendy Davis is going to join us shortly. She's been with the 21st Century Dems pretty much all year, and she's going to share some wisdom with that. Also, she'll just kind of sit in with us this week. Catherine is still partying for the holidays, so she can't join us today, but that's okay, and she'll be back. She's for the new year, recharged and ready to share her opinion. So this is the kind of year where everybody kind of takes a little time off to regenerate anyway, it seems. So we're good, and I tell you what, we were just talking about this a minute ago. The blogs are slow. You look at the national blogs, the state blogs, and the southern states. I will say this, Mooncat over in Alabama, I was looking at Left in Alabama. Now, she's been really on it. She's one of the few that I think she's produced more content than most recently, but it's just that time of year. Yeah, well, Wendy will call in a second. We'll get her on, but in the meantime, we'll also, as in addition to political stuff, we're going to keep checking playoff scenarios because I know a lot of the, at least, Southern fans checking Falcons scores and others, but and keeping up with things, but that's in addition to our politics. Tim, I guess one of the first things that kind of caught my eye, and we'll get Wendy's opinion when she comes on, was it looks like they've had pre-census numbers, and they seem to do this every year, and it really doesn't matter a lot until you get right towards the end of a 10-year cycle, and we're just one more year of growth. But it looks like that both Georgia and North Carolina will gain seats. Texas will gain seats. How many seats is Texas going to gain, Tim? Do you know?
Four. According to this reapportionment study.
Yes, and it didn't look like a lot of southern states were going to lose. Like last time, Mississippi was a southern state that lost, but they're not going to lose any additional seats. I don't think I saw any other states that are going to lose. Is Virginia going to gain one? I got to pull that.
Looks like Virginia's going to hold right where it is. But the Sun Belt, the Sun Belt's going to do quite well, though, David. And this trend of the Northeast and Rust Belt states losing seats seems to be continuing, don't it?
Oh, yes. I saw that New York is only going to lose one. I think Ohio's going to lose two. But in North Carolina, I'm not sure exactly where. I'm sure it's around the Research Triangle. They're gonna that'll be where their additional seat comes in at. And then in Georgia, okay. The population's gaining, and of course that's more in the metro area. But then that may actually impact several districts. So it'd be hard to say, but I think we've both heard rumors. There could be one of the things they could do is they could take some of those northern suburban counties out of the 9th and the 11th district and then create two more northwest and northeast-based districts and then use that population to kind of reconfigure some of the suburban districts, if you will.
Well, it looks like one thing they could do, David, is finally just give Cobb County their own district. You know, Cobb County, in my memory at least, has been split.
Yeah.
They have a population now of close to 700,000. They could have their own district, and that would pave the way for the creation, finally, of that pure Northwest Georgia district that we've all heard about. And let's don't forget that at least one state senator in Northwest Georgia is part of the Senate leadership that would be looking at this, and that's Jeff Mullis.
Yes, I mean, I know he's in favor of having that Northwest Georgia district. The one thing about Cobb, well, there's two things. One, the number may actually get up to 800,000 to be a congressional district, so they would have to have a sliver of somewhere else, but it could still be a dominant Cobb district. But the one thing to remember is the Republicans will be in control of Georgia most likely. I mean, they'll certainly, you'd have to think they control two of the branches. branches, if not all three by then, hopefully not all three, but they would not probably want to put a just a Cobb district, because you got to think we're only a few years away, you'd think, from given demographic shifts from Cobb becoming Democratic, or at least a real battleground that they had to spend a lot of money in. And they
That's true.
Some of that population in with David Scott or someone like that.
But if you added East Cobb in, wouldn't it forestall any gains that we have made in working Cobb?
Well, it would be in the short term, but then eventually it would be a battleground. And but it may be that they have to create a battleground somewhere. Well, Wendy Davis has called on in. Welcome, Wendy.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Hey, Wendy.
Yes. Well,
long time no chat.
Oh, that's okay. I remember the last time you were on with us, you were out in Denver talking with us right before the convention started. But, Wendy, I guess the first thing I wanted to talk to you about was you were spent a lot of time with 21st Century Dems. I guess you're there through the first of the year, somewhere around there. Tell us some kind of lessons you learned working at 21st Century Dems.
Well, you know, the exciting thing, I was, in more than a dozen states and really active in a big way in a number of states. And, of course, the exciting thing you learn going across the country is how different everybody is and then also how similar everybody is. So rural Montana, totally different breed of folks. However, they really are a lot like rural Georgia. You know, and so you had similar concerns that you have here in rural Georgia, how you have to, how you can be a Democrat and not the kind of Democrat you would find in DeKalb County, right? But the Democrats can be successful if they are responsive to the electorate and they happen to be gun friendly. It was funny out there, apparently every mailer you send out, you have to have a picture of your candidate with a gun, even if it's like, you know, an education flyer. So it's not just the occasional gunshot. You've got to make sure people know you hunt and fish and all that. But it's really exciting. All their legislative races out there are won in really close margins, and they have 100 people in their House and 50 people in the Senate, and we were able to do a lot of good work there and gain the majority out there on the work we did there. We worked in a county in Michigan called Oakland County, which is a classic swing county, and we were able to get this guy who had been a state legislator elected countywide as county treasurer. And the exciting thing there was we worked with him for a year and a half and did all his number crunching and helped him with all his targeting, and all his staff came to our training, and it was really exciting sort of watching what you have theoretically get implemented. And they really, you know, did our model of a yes list and being, you know, adamant about their field outreach and being really responsive to the voters, and ended up being very successful. And not just because it was a nice Democratic wave in Michigan, but because they had really done the field work and the groundwork.
I wanted to jump in with a quick question since you were on the ground in Montana. Why did Barack Obama run so well in a state like that?
Because he worked it. And really, they had a huge field presence there, even though they didn't do the investment there that they did in some of the other states. But they had, you know, dozens of field organizers on the ground, and really, really worked the larger population centers very hard.
Okay.
And had a very well coordinated campaign with the popular Democrats there. Governor Schweitzer and the senator there are very, very popular. So it was an exciting time to be a Democrat in Montana. But those local races were still very, very local, and it didn't matter if they were for Obama or against Obama. They voted for a lot of our Democratic candidates there locally.
Yes. Now, you were mentioning guns, and that made me think about, mm-hmm. you know, one, this year, guns of any type of gun issues were not a big issue. But then, I mean, you got to think, typically in rural areas, it's about rifles and hunting weapons. And even, you know, your most liberal politicians from urban areas, I don't hear a lot of them wanting to come after hunting rifles. Why do you think?
No, it's
such a big issue? I mean, when it's really not an issue.
Because the Republicans have done a beautiful, brilliant job of making it an issue.
But how do the people get duped by this, you know, into making them think it's a real issue?
Because we haven't done a good job of addressing it. I mean, frankly, you know, it's the kind of thing of, you know, so often, just like any of the polarizing issues, Democrats, we kind of get scared and we kind of get quiet and we're kind of so worried about saying the wrong thing that we craft this completely mushy message that doesn't resonate, you know, and it takes 4 or 5 or 10 sentences, whereas the Republicans are like, he's going to take away your guns. It doesn't matter if it's true or not.
But, Wendy, didn't you discover that this year in particular the economy just blew those cultural issues off the map?
Oh, yeah. I was, it was, you know, the economy, stupid, is our favorite quote, right, from way back in 92. but this year, the election, you know, there were certainly people on our side who believed the whole time that Obama was going to win it all. But it really, it was that, you know, the big mess in Washington, you know, the week McCain put his campaign on hold and all that stuff with the bailout and everything, that was really the turning point in a lot of ways that just, you know, gunned the accelerator for Obama toward November 4th. And it was that October 1st, people getting their statements from their retirement funds and seeing how much they had lost. I mean, it was just, all these economic factors just came together in such a horrible, horrible way. And obviously the people who were in leadership in Washington had no solutions.
But that was equally true in rural Montana as well as the big population centers of Michigan, right? The economy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, it was everywhere. I mean, it was really the turning point. It was really the factor. And, I mean, again, you've got to give Obama credit, whereas originally, you know, when I was working for Governor Richardson, I was infuriated because I was like, change to what? You know, what does that mean? Well, the brilliant thing, of course, is it meant whatever the voter wanted it to mean in a very positive way. And then, of course, by the time, you know, as we got closer and closer, you know, it didn't matter what we were going to change to. Anything had to be better than where we are. So, and particularly in terms of the economy. And you just saw the economy trumping every other issue. I mean, gosh, at the end, nobody was even thinking about the war. I mean, it was just all the economy all the time.
It was kind of like, you know, basically the change, and I think for a lot of Democrats it was kind of ironic, it became the Clinton peace and prosperity with a zipper included. And that's why if it was just the peace and prosperity, Hillary Clinton could have won, but then it was almost like, and they didn't even say it was like without the, you know, the negative Oval Office stuff, because, I mean, Barack Obama, I mean, there's just never been any insinuation that he's just not, you know, totally committed to his marriage, so therefore he didn't have all that baggage, and I think it was just
let's hope it stays
perfect,
that way.
Yeah, but there's no indication. Obviously, I mean, as much as we may have said, hey, Bill Clinton's the man to lead our nation in a, you know, truly on the job sense, I mean, everybody knew that, you know, there are, you know, issues surrounding, if you will, but there's just no, so I think you got the persona along with the hope that this guy has the vision. I mean, obviously he wasn't in the executive branch before, but you saw that, you know, how he handled himself, he certainly seemed ready. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the most fascinating thing, of course, because, I mean, y'all know me for years. I'm a field girl in my heart. I mean, I have been the person who is screaming at every turn, you have to have a field plan, you have to have a ground game, we've got to be connecting with voters. And so often I was, you know, overshadowed by all these people, well, you just got to buy your TV commercials, your negative mail, and blah, blah, blah. Well, I think the great thing we saw this year is no one can deny that the field effort really, really made the difference. And we had more field organizers, you know, than I think we'd ever had in America, unless you, you know, go back well beyond, you know, well further than my time when we actually had, you know, Democratic block captains on every block. But this was a great engagement, and I think we have to keep that in mind going forward, that it takes that effort. It takes that really serious communication of voter to voter to move things. But I guess the negative I saw was all the down ballot drop off. You know, there was all this excitement with all these new voters going out there and voting for Obama, but they don't consider themselves Democrats. They don't consider themselves progressives. They were just excited about being a part of making change. And so our job, I think, going forward is to keep connected with those voters and keep them engaged in the process and turn them into Democrats. You know, help them recognize that there is a benefit to being active in the party and considering themselves a part of our party that will, you know, keep these ideas forward beyond this one personality, beyond his presidency, you know, into the foreseeable future.
Yes. Now, you were talking about ground game versus mail and media. Now, we know that, you know, Howard Dean's been in charge of the Democratic Party and big on the 50-state strategy, and now Rahm Emanuel's coming in as Barack Obama's chief of staff. You would assume that, you know, the president, new president's administration is going to choose the leader of the party. Do you think you're going to see us get away from the ground game and go back to targeting just a few districts and then putting money into media? What is your sense of what you've been hearing in D.C.?
Well, frankly, I'm nervous about it, and it bothers me because Obama and his whole team were big advocates of the 50-state strategy. I mean, I know we were disappointed here in Georgia that they ended up pulling their people out, but goodness, we'd never had that many people on the ground in Georgia from any presidential campaign that I can remember. So they believed in putting resources in these quote-unquote unwinnable places. I mean, they were smart. They put more resources into the winnable places, but I'm very concerned because in every state they have let go of those staffers that were the DNC staffers.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can go, well, you've got to be fiscally smart. This is not a time when they've got a lot of money. You know, they need to wait and get their guy in and, you know, revamp it or whatever. But to me, you know, here in Georgia, it was three people. Okay, those three people, whether you like them or not, they weren't, you know, they were good folks. They're never perfect, but they have a lot of institutional knowledge and they have a lot of relationships that it took a lot of time to build. And okay, now they're out looking for a job. They're good people. They're going to find a job someplace else. And even if in February or March the DNC decides to recommit resources to the states to hire those slots back, don't have lost all those people.
Yeah, I mean,
I think that's very concerning.
One of those people was Ted Terry and what he did with voter files and getting with people. I mean, he came on the ground at times. I know Bob Puckett's district was targeted. He stayed nearly a week. And, I mean, he really worked hard. I mean, I haven't heard anybody say anything negative about Ted's work. And I know that was one of the DNC slots. Now, obviously, if the state party's paying somebody and in Georgia and Ted was a DNC slot, then if that person moves on, you could just slide Ted in if you so wanted, chose, because, I mean, he is a sharp guy and was doing a good job on the voter file in particular.
Well, and think about that, is actually most of the, and pardon me for using this, but I'm feeling so old. They're all kids to me. I mean, they're so young. I mean, they're smart as can be, and they're adults. But, you know, it's that energy and that youth and that vigor and that technical sophistication that sort of comes with that generation. In almost every state I saw, you know, the data guy or the data gal was the DNC slot. So just think of the technological leaps and bounds we have made across the country with this vote builder, the VAN, whichever you want to call it, that voter file. It's been enormous. But again, what Ted Terry knows about the Georgia voter file, in a lot of ways, is now priceless. I mean, he's spent a year working it, massaging it, understanding it. And so what? Now he might go to, you know, Timbuktu to find a job, and we're going to lose that knowledge. And that worries me because it's going to happen, you know, in state after state after state. I worked really really closely with folks in Delaware, and, I mean, they were all let go, you know. And it's just, again, you can get people back in there, and they can learn the stuff, but I just think you're making a mistake. I mean, you're always going to lose people. But if you, like, lose them on purpose, you know, or say, okay, well, we might pick you up in 3 months, so just hang on. I mean, it's just, I don't think it's a smart use of resources. And frankly, the Obama folks have more money than anybody has ever, again, in my memory, had. So I think they could have, you know, hung on. And if they want to make changes and tweak the program or make it more accountable or make it more uniform, whatever it is they want to do to change the program, you know, then you can make the adjustments. But I think just cutting back is falling into that same bad habit of everything being about the cycle. You know, yeah. you build up for the cycle, and then when the campaign's over, you let everybody go. And the next time, you have to start all over again. You know, well, who's the county chair in DeKalb County? Who's the county chair in Fulton County? Lord knows. Who's county chair in Chittenden County? You know, these folks
I know.
Know
I know.
And but, I just think it's regrettable. I really do.
Yes, and that's and there's just certain people they could keep on, because, I mean, and the state parties everywhere. It's not just Georgia. I know, like, for instance, Mississippi's got an interim person right now, and that's another one of the states we cover. Now, Wendy, you may have heard a little bit of our conversation when you came on about reapportionment and looking at, you know, where areas are going to gain. And I think you've worked in some of the census data before. In the South, it looks like South Carolina will gain a seat, Georgia will gain a seat, Florida only gained one seat, Texas as many as four, it looks like. I know Southern states losing. What do you see as far as actually Louisiana is going to lose a seat. There will be a Southern state to lose a seat. What do you think about, in particular, Georgia, but any of those other states gaining a seat and what that will mean?
Well, I'm obviously, anytime Georgia gains a seat, we're all delighted, and I happen to be cheering along with Tim for a true Northwest Georgia district, which we've certainly not had since before the 60s. We've always had to let Cobb County have the focus of this district, so I'd love to see that. But you never know how they're going to carve it up. I mean, in any of these states, obviously, the growth has been in Metro Atlanta, so they could do a lot of things with it. So, and unless we work exceedingly hard between now and 2010, unfortunately, the Republicans are going to be calling the shots. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, that give and take happens. You know, we were in charge, however, back in the 80s and also in the early 90s, and we didn't necessarily do a good job with it. So, I mean, that's why having governors in place and having legislatures with some Democratic control is oh so important in 2010. I'm real excited about South Carolina. I don't know if it hit y'all's radar screen. There was a terrific candidate out of Charleston, and she did a heck of a job, ended up falling short. But, you know, there's a chance that district could be changed, the configuration changed a little bit, and it be more of a, I mean, urban isn't quite the right word, but a less rural district there out of Charleston, and maybe she'd take a run at it again. So that could be exciting in South Carolina, because we did make a lot of progress in South Carolina. It's not quite measurable progress. I don't think we turned the tide yet in South Carolina, but I know the party really worked hard, and it got a lot further down the road than anybody would have expected in South Carolina. Texas is going to be fascinating. I mean, Texas is always fascinating, but the Hispanic political community in Texas is really stepping up and moving forward. So it would be really interesting to see, you know, the dynamic out there becomes, you know, the Anglo-Hispanic rather than the, you know, the black-white that we have here in Georgia. But, you know, the drawing the lines out there is going to be everything. And, gosh, with four new seats, that could be just, you know, a showdown out there, guns a-blazing. The most exciting thing about this chart is Iowa's going to lose one. And I think anything that takes Iowa back a step or two would make me personally happy as I'm sitting here reflecting upon freezing in Iowa last Christmas. But
Well, that doesn't affect the Iowa caucuses. That's, you know, that's where they're
coming
from.
I'm working on that, David. I'm working on affecting the Iowa caucus. That's my personal mission. It's
Wendy. No states are losing more than two seats. It's the most I see, and that's Ohio. Tim, right. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask a question about this thing, Wendy, since you've worked with the census stuff before. South Carolina has lost a lot of jobs, yet they are gaining enough population to pick up a seat. What's going on in that state? Where is the population coming from, and what's it coming there for?
This industry is really booming there. I can't quite explain it. I spent a little bit of time outside of Columbia, too, and it looked like Alpharetta 10 years ago. I mean, it was just all this new construction and all these really fancy, what do you call them, those live, work, and play areas where you had, you know, an office condominium complex next to a housing condominium complex next to a retail center. I mean, it was, you know, all this really well-planned neighborhood kind of work. And I just was like, where's the money for this? But people are just pouring in.
Yeah, and Anderson, Columbia,
yeah.
Some in Charleston, not as much, are all
right.
Going there. Columbia's really a nice city. I actually went there about 3 years ago. And I know what you're talking about. On the north side of Columbia,
mm-hmm.
there was one
mm-hmm.
area, and it had a shopping mall that was, I mean, if you put it in Atlanta, it would be one of probably the top three. It wouldn't be as big as Mall of Georgia, but
mm-hmm.
would certainly be nice. It was real funny then in the middle of all this growth was this old restaurant, which we saw in one of the guides called D.L. McLaughlin's. Now, my son, D.L. McLaughlin, Dylan Lee, we took a picture with him in front of it, and it was totally lost on him, which was about 5 at the time that this place happened to have a change. But I know exactly what you're talking about. But I would think that some of that growth might be around the Greenville area. And if it's around that area, that's not necessarily going to be a Democratic area, but that does sometimes, you manipulate lines one place and it helps you in another place.
Right. Well, again, that coastal corridor is a lot more Democratic than you might think, other than, you know, the big houses part. You know, the big houses enclave, you know, on the beach is still, you know, Republican, but... But it's interesting. I think it has to do, you know, they've had a lot of gains in the car industry. You know, with the I know they have at least one plant there. They might have two. But I really think the service industry and obviously in Charleston the tourism is where the growth is coming from. And everybody's fleeing those cold states. And again, having been in Iowa last year, I have no idea why anybody would stay in the winter. I mean, you can't even take your poor dog outside because the snow's up to its ears.
Well, I mean, speaking of that, we were talking about Florida. You know, Florida just seems like it always grows. Only one electoral vote growth for Florida, which is surprising. But then another thing, you were talking about Hispanic growth. How much have some of these states grown, but they're not? It's not going to be growth that actually means seats because it's undocumented population growth. And I think
the interesting thing is the census counts documented and undocumented people. So, and I don't know if, you know, if they're counted differently toward the, you know, toward the reapportionment. I mean, only figures I've ever seen are just, you know, voting age pop figures, you know, so that doesn't distinguish between them. But,
yeah.
You know, we're trying to count everybody, whether you've got a house or not, whether you've got papers or not, so in the census. So
yeah.
It'll be interesting, too. Governor Richardson, you know, he's the designee for Commerce, and Commerce does the census. And so it will be interesting to see with, you know, an African-American president and a Hispanic head of the Commerce Department, then the work of the census is always, you know, needs to be very sensitive to these, you know, sort of populations that don't look like the three of us and have a lot of time, a difficult time, reaching particularly into immigrant communities because there's a lot of nervousness about where that information is going to go. So hopefully with at least the images of the people up front being a more welcoming image than it might have been in the past, maybe we'll do a better job with this census of actually counting all the folks that are here.
Yes. And so that's just something we'll keep looking at. And it's the thing can be analyzed until we actually see the numbers. But it's just so fascinating. Other than the actual elections themselves, it's probably the second most intriguing thing about politics is looking at the maps, if you will. I guess kind of taking it back to some local issues, One that grabbed me, that which is certainly a, you know, always a political football, certainly so to speak, is where ball stadiums are going to be put, because beyond just going to the ball game and watching them, what they mean as far as economic development. And in the last 2 weeks, we've seen two different plans for building a new football stadium for Atlanta. And the first one was, in about 10 years, building a new stadium, or maybe as soon as five, that's going to be part of the World Congress Center. But then a proposal came in for using the old GM site in Doraville to use that as a football stadium. And I just hate to see the city of Atlanta, where it's going to be the city of everybody, at the center for everybody on every side of town, lose the stadium. But, Tim, what's your thoughts on, you know, these two stadium proposals?
Well, the old GM plant site out in Doraville, there's 165 acres or so available. It would take about 90 acres for the proposed stadium, and the rest of it would be in developments and stuff. I do know this. Somewhere between 2015 and 2020, the Georgia Dome bonds are going to be paid off, and then they're going to have to make a decision about, you know, issuing new bonds or whatever they're going to do. I know the World Congress Center oversees the Georgia Domes, if I'm not mistaken. The problem here, City of Atlanta is really broke. I wonder if they'll be able to push a bond issue through to rebuild the Georgia Dome on the present site.
Well, you think the convention business is so important to Atlanta. Also, Arthur Blank is truly an Atlanta citizen, gives a lot to Atlanta causes, and so you just don't see him moving the team. It doesn't make a lot of sense, and I noticed on the Georgia gang, even the most conservative members like Phil Kent were saying, hey, I just don't see the team moving out of Atlanta, and I just don't see a new mayor about midterm, I guess, maybe when this will get done, having this happen on their watch.
Well,
been involved. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
I was just going to say there's another thing to consider, too. The final answer is going to have to be a new stadium. They cannot stay in the present Georgia Dome. It's 16 years old. There are now 20 NFL stadiums that are newer. Guess where the Super Bowls go? To the newer stadiums.
In reality terms, absolutely they can stay in that stadium. Under the current sports climate in which everybody has to have a stadium that's no older than 20 years, oh, no, they have. It's keeping up with the Joneses. It's like everything else in American society. Everybody's got to have newer things. But I mean, we just understand the reality of how these things function. Wendy,
right.
You've been involved with some stadium projects before. What is your initial thought on that?
Well, my initial thought is that that there will be whoever the next mayor of Atlanta is, they would probably, you know, have a stroke from being so furious if anybody really did try to take the stadium out of Atlanta, particularly out of downtown. Now, there will be interests that will say, oh, nobody wants to go downtown, and let's move it out closer to the burbs and blah, blah, blah. But I really can't see the business interests. As much money has been invested in that corridor, and as much as that convention area and arena brings so much to the state, I can't see it going. But, I mean, there's just no way to know what the dynamics will be even 5 years down the road. I mean, obviously stadium proposals that are in front of voters are as successful as often as they're unsuccessful, you know, depending on how it's pitched. And the city of Atlanta is in a, you know, financial turmoil, to say the least, right now. So it's really, I mean, I think that one's just kind of too far down the road to say, other than there are a lot of people who would, you know, fight to the death to keep it downtown. And I think their passion is stronger than the folks who would kind of like to move it elsewhere.
Well, and so, that's the thing I've always talked about, is how a stadium, even if you put it, oh, where all the people live, well, you have a lot of people that live in Jonesboro, live in Morrow, live in Macon, McDonough, Fayetteville, that come to the games, that's further away for them. But, you know, we have a caller on the Kudzu Vine, caller from the 276. Welcome to the Kudzu Vine. What you got? Well, our caller jumped off. Maybe they were calling in just to listen, which does happen. Don't want to run you off if you want to call back in. I don't know. It just usually we see people call in. They want to get on because you can obviously listen live. And if you do want to call in, the number is 646-478-4503. I'm talking about other local issues. I saw
David, I'm sorry, yeah. 1 second before you jump off that. The other thing I do want to say is I think the Doraville plant site, the redevelopment plans should take off for there much sooner than this potential for the stadium being revamped too.
Yes, and I mean, personally what I would like to see built on the Doraville plant site and on the Hapeville Ford plant site would be people buy American cars, and then we would have to have more car plants.
Amen.
And then GM could reopen that plant, and then Ford could reopen the Taurus plant. And don't even, you know, I guess if this show would have existed, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, we'd have talked about that ad nauseum, how you take the car plant that's building the number one car in America, and it was beating the Toyota and the Honda, whatever was before that and after that, the number one car, the Honda Accord, beating that, and you stop using that plant. For some reason, to me, you reward your workers that are making mm-hmm. the most popular product. And I know a lot of that had to do with, you know, the design, the marketing, not just the full building it, but still, I just would think there'd be a little magic to that plant that you want to keep using it. And I don't even really remember what car they built in GM, but if they were building more cars, if they were buying more American cars, maybe they could do that with those sites. But I tell you, too,
we should have fought to keep it, and we just let them close it, and we didn't fight to keep it. And I lay that square at Sonny Perdue's feet. You don't just wait until they've made the decision and then go, hey, guys, really? Is that what you're going to do? I mean, they knew it was coming. They knew it was coming, and we could have fought and kicked and screamed. And as much as we give away the store – to get, you know, a company that's going to come in with $7 an hour jobs, we should have done a lot more and offered a lot more to be partners in keeping those jobs here. And I think the state government, Sonny Perdue, let us down.
Yeah, but that, Wendy, those $15, $25 an hour workers, they would have voted for a Democrat, so we didn't need them. You know that.
Wendy,
Wendy, let me remind you of something else, too, that you know too well. That's the way it's been in this state since the Republicans have taken over. A do-nothing legislature supported by a do-nothing governor. It's the darndest thing I've ever seen.
Well, and what'd they do? They just shrugged? Did they even shed a tear? They just lost 1,400 jobs in Albany. That tire company closed.
Yep.
1,400 jobs. Can you imagine if we lost 1,400 jobs up here, and we have, but, I mean, from one company, I mean, it's just phenomenal.
In one of the poorest cities in Georgia, far as a large population center in a place that's not Atlanta, where that plant is so much more critical, and, you know, and we talk about, you know, one Georgia, and I guess that's not Sonny Perdue. That would have been his first lieutenant governor that talked a lot about that, keeping jobs throughout the state, and that's also how you have growth throughout the state, and not overpopulation in one area. But I guess another thing struck me, people were discussing the legacy of Vernon Jones, and people made the statement, you know, DeKalb County, it's a better place than it was 8 years ago, and that could be true, but then how much do y'all think that's attributable to Vernon Jones? Wendy, I know it's been a long time, it's well before Vernon Jones' time, but you actually were a DeKalb County resident. I've had relatives living in DeKalb County, but once again, it's been a little while. Your first thoughts on Vernon's legacy?
You know, Vernon's legacy could have been positive if he hadn't just run for Senate and run such a ridiculous campaign. Because really, he was very successful as CEO. And if he had just spent all the time talking about, you know, the successful investments he was able to make in the county and how they had produced, you know, the kind of return you want from your local investments, then he might have been a credible candidate for the U.S. Senate. Unfortunately, Vernon's charm and personality, if you will, get in the way of a lot of the good things he's done. And again, he had to go out picking a fight with the new guy. You know, it's like he can't get out of the way of his own success. but he has. I mean, DeKalb County has done well, and he did show good leadership in terms of economic development and in terms of being responsive. He was very responsive. South DeKalb had always felt like the redheaded stepchild of the county, and he did a good job of bringing those people into, you know, their concerns to the forefront. So, I mean, I've got to give him a lot of credit for that. But again, his personality just gets in the way of his success, and I think it's a shame. I mean, obviously there are a lot of outside factors too, but I mean, the economy hasn't been raging in Georgia for a number of years, but I think he's been able to put a lot of good things together there in DeKalb County.
Yes, I know that mall, Stonegate, Stonebridge, it may not be either one of those, you know, the mall near the, it's in South DeKalb, out 20 near the Rockdale Coastline. I know that's been a lot of commercial development. I'm sure he helped some of the second and third phases of that. And really, I guess one thing is DeKalb County, in the during the last decade, a lot of black middle-class families have come to DeKalb to give it a real strong base as the transition came through. Basically, a lot of folks probably like Burl Ellis. His family came through, so it's kind of and I don't know why he wants to pick such a fight, but it just seems, that it's he could have used all that negative energy if he did on things at times and positives, it could have been even better. Tim, any quick thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, if you write a history of Vernon Jones in DeKalb County, the first thing you're going to say was the obvious. He was the first African-American CEO of DeKalb County. But the second thing, David, that most people are going to remember is what Wendy has already mentioned, and that's that election loss that he had this year and the way he acted during it. And a lot of Democrats are going to remember that he supported a lot of Republicans, including George Bush. I can't get over that one myself.
Yes. Turning to another local issue, kind of two in one since it's in the same county. Clayton County, there was an education and a health care issue that came out. One, a Clayton County school system, which has been in a lot of peril. It looks like Jonesboro High, which is pretty much the highest performing school for about 20 years now in the county, is looking to become a magnet school. Traditionally, magnet schools do very well, like Ware Magnet down in Waycross, an area which is not known for, you know, some of the schools in South Georgia. They don't usually compete in test scores and other things with schools around the metro area. But Ware Magnet does. There's also a Richmond Academy, which is a public school over in the Augusta area, does very well. Is this something that could hold up and be kind of like the engine that pulls Clayton County? Tim, quick thought on this.
Well, the school board, you know, is going to have to approve it. I'm not so sure if they can. They've lost $27 million in state funding because of accreditation, and the county has lost 3,200 students. So where are they going to get the students for this?
Well, I mean, that's just saying it's Clayton. I mean, Jonesboro High is the main one, and then maybe people come back to it. I guess that's the theory of the word magnet. It attracts some. Wendy, quick thought.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I think the way I saw it was they have to fix their accreditation problem before we can even talk about whether there's a magnet school or not.
Right.
So,
right.
First of all, that means they've got to get a lot of their ducks back in a row, which is the first big hurdle for them. Second of all, my question, I think you've seen a lot of success with magnet schools, and the only question I always have is, do you displace the normal geographic population of the school by having the magnet part, or is that just an add-on to the school, if that makes sense? Because I would hate that you'd have to send a kid who lives next door to the school, you know, 10 miles away to go to school if he or she did not perform, you know, to the standard of these new admission standards.
Well, and that may be why
and that always makes me a little nervous. So.
And that may be why it works so well in Ware County. You just have two schools both located in Waycross, one magnet, one for everybody else, and they're both there together. Now, one thing I got to thinking, if Jonesboro is performing well, why don't you do a lower-performing school that's still centrally located, like, say, Morrow or a junior high, and turn it into a magnet school for junior and high school, and then you would still keep the higher-performing school in that area, and then some of those students could go to the magnet school. I guess staying with Clayton County, health care issues, and it seems to kind of, to me, it kind of ties a lot into Grady. Southern Regional Hospital is having trouble making ends meet, and, you know, they've talked about closing its doors, just like Grady had trouble. And it seems like this is just systemic of a bigger health care issue we have nationwide. What's your first thought on that, Wendy?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I wish people would grasp the fact that if we had people universally insured at some level in America, it would be better for everybody. It would help these hospitals. The reason these hospitals are floundering is because they are drowning in caring for uninsured patients. Because, I mean, just think about this cascading thing. When you don't have your child insured, or when the parent is not insured, you're not going to go to the doctor for normal routine things. You're not going to go to the doctor when you first get sick. You're only going to go to the doctor when you're so sick that you have to go to the doctor. And if you had gone to the doctor when you first started having the sniffles, if you will, you know, they could have done something about it that didn't cost a fortune. But if you wait until, you know, the child's ear is totally infected and they might lose their hearing, it's a lot more expensive. And so if we were all covered, people would be healthier, and it would cost less in the end. I mean, the big picture, it would cost less. It would save everybody money, and it would save these hospitals, because these hospitals are drowning from having to cover these uninsured people. And don't get me wrong, I think we need to take care of our people, but I think the best way economically and for good social reasons and ethical reasons, we should find a way to let people have affordable health insurance.
Yes, Tim, is this a local issue, or is this just a systemic national issue?
Well, it's both. Here's the bottom line. That's Clayton County's only hospital. I mean, what are the people there going to do without this hospital? On the other hand, they lost $7 million this year. It takes $20 million a month for this hospital to run. The hospital has asked the county for help. The county said, sorry, we're broke. I'm going to tell you something, David. You know this county well. Clayton County is just in a mess.
Well, Tim, and probably South Fulton, I believe, closed up for a time, may still be closed. That was a hospital that now Southern Regional probably serves that population. What will happen if Southern Regional closes is most of the folks will then go to Fayette and Henry Hospitals. They won't pay their bills. It won't take long till those two hospitals are having financial struggles. So I guess then what happens next is they close their doors, and it just goes on and on and on until you go upriver and you find the cause. Well, Tim, I know that it's getting close to that time where we're ready for the outrage of the week, so we're ready when you are.
Well, David, since this is the last show of 2008, I think that now is an appropriate time not to do an outrage of the week, but to do a Republican outrage of the year. Now, I know that everybody's mind is suddenly whirling with bad visions of dumb things said and done by people like Sarah Palin or Glenn Richardson. But for this outrage, I pick none other than the RNC and Republicans who espouse their talking points. For years, these Republicans, and George Bush in particular, crowed about the wonderful economy that they had created with their policies. While they tooted their horns, they were ignoring the warning signs of trouble that was coming back as far as 2005 with the subprime stuff. And on September 15th of this year, it all arrived in a big way. Now, we can all argue until we're blue in the face about the wisdom of the government's response to this crisis. That isn't the real problem I'm having with all of this subprime and economic mess. The thing that is making me mad right now is this blame game that the GOP is playing. You've all by now heard their so-called reasoning about who was at fault, and wouldn't you just know that it was all the Democrats' fault. They gave out this fanciful story about Bill Clinton and how he let Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac give bad loans to the poor for houses they couldn't afford, and they said that Barney Frank and Chris Dodd were bought and paid for since they controlled the oversight committees in the House and Senate, and they said that all of the problems with the economy have occurred since the Democrats took over the Congress in January of 2007. Well, first of all, they're blaming Bill Clinton folks, he's been gone for nearly 8 years, and it's his fault? I suppose that they're making some allusion to the Financial Modernization Act of 1999, which Clinton signed into law. Of course, none of them have offered any proof that this law affected anything that's going on now. And I mean not one shred of proof. I might also add gently here that the original bill had its principal author none other than Senator Phil Graham. But have the Republicans blamed any of this on him? Why, of course not. And those bad loans to the poor? Well, sorry, but the SEC and the Fed both now say that most of the bad loans were issued to middle and upper income folks. And let me ask this. Why is Barney Frank one of their whipping boys? They say that all of this happened while he chaired the House Oversight Committee and that he opposed any regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Well, for starters, he didn't take over as chairman until last year while the Republicans held that chairmanship for the previous 12 years. And secondly, the Democrats did try to pass a regulatory bill, and their efforts were brushed aside. Who led this effort to pass this bill? Why, none other than Representative Mike Oxley of Maryland, I believe, and Barney Frank. And finally, isn't this excuse that it's all the fault of the Democratic-controlled Congress getting just a little bit lame with you folks? What has this Congress been able to do? Well, very little. Why is that? Well, because their efforts were thwarted by Republican senators who threatened filibusters and by vetoes from George Bush. So, I must ask these questions. Why is nothing ever the fault of the Republicans? Why do they never take responsibility for their failures, even when presented with facts? And the facts clearly show that the subprime mess was not caused by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It was caused by private mortgage lenders. Now, how do I know this? Well, guess what percentage of bad loans were held by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? 16. That's all. And you know how many bad mortgages were written by Fannie Mae, by the way? The answer is none. Zero. Fannie Mae buys mortgages. It doesn't write them. And of the top 25 mortgage writers, you know how many of those companies are regulated? Well, one, Freddie Mac. These two companies were victims, not causes. Also, who caused the other economic problems? What about high prices for gasoline and groceries? What about new home construction going in the tank? What about the highest unemployment rate in 15 years? What about the worst budget deficits ever? What about the automobile industry? What about the state and local governments that are going bankrupt all over this country? Well, I know whose lap to lay it all in, the lap of George Bush. He's been up there for 8 years. He bragged 5 years ago that his policies made sure that everyone who wanted to own a house in this country had one. He said his tax cuts for the rich would bring more prosperity. Oh, gee. I know I speak for many when I close with this question. Can Obama take office early? And a final hopeful word in this final week of 2008. We have lived in an environment for the last 8 years where shadowy figures are everywhere among us, and in a time where those in power have told us that we had to be with them lest we be both against the nation and God. We have seen our civil rights taken away in the name of safety. We have seen people jailed with no charge. We have witnessed a brutal attack on our own soil, in part because those in power ignored the enemy that hit us until it was too late. We have seen a war forced upon a sovereign nation by us and predicated on a pack of lies. And we have paid a dear price in treasury and human life as a result. And we have witnessed the best economy in our history turned into the worst economic calamity since the Great Depression. But in 23 days, a new figure begins to make his mark on the world stage. He inherits major problems, yes. He needs our best efforts. He needs our prayers. It gives me hope to see this son of an African man and a Kansas woman make this historical move and the dreams of all who dared to dream this dream become a reality. Yes, we did, David.
Well, Tim, that was great, and you encompassed so much in just one outrage. And you segued so nicely into two topics about George Bush we hadn't gotten to. You just have to wonder, given his what he's done in 8 years, what two books a week is he actually reading? they said Heidi, could he read two books, but what has he been reading? You think he would, even my pet goat might teach him something good.
I don't think comic books should count in that either, by the way.
but I mean, I did see, I mean, I think people saw that on the national blogosphere and were like, really? I mean, cause I don't know about y'all, but I mean, when you start working and getting busy, it's hard to get one book in every 2 weeks. And you'd think he'd be just a tad busy at the job he does. I know at least he doesn't have a long time to commute from the east to the west wing. I guess that's the upside. But Wendy, when you saw that, what did you think?
Well, first of all, I didn't believe it. And then second of all, you do have to question what were the titles. And, you know, I mean, again, even if you're reading fiction, you know, some tales, most fiction has the good guys being rewarded and the bad guys being punished. And Bush doesn't seem to have that straight because he keeps trafficking with bad people and making bad decisions. But, I mean, he's clearly not been working hard. I mean, I think you got to work a lot harder than he does to be president. I think maybe one of the things I think you had talked about, David, too, was that portrait of him all casual. That's so appropriate that his portrait looks like he's vacationing, because I think in addition to history finding that he will definitely go down in history as the worst president we've had in this country, I'm sure he has the record for the most vacation days of any chief executive in America.
Yes, you're talking about fiction. I guess you're referring to the story of how uranium makes its way to Iraq. Or...
Exactly. Yellow cake, the true story. Yeah, that fiction.
I mean, yeah, but you had to think. It was like, my goodness. And I will tell you this. I listened to this whole biography about the Bush family, and it started out with before Prescott, and it went all the way to George and Jeb. And one thing that struck me is I guess they really thought people that listen to this book are not going to be familiar with the Bible. It talked about how the president would read the Bible in a year. And, you know, we've seen many copies of that where you it breaks the Bible up into 365 chunks. And that's a wonderful thing to do. But it talked about how during the recount decision, he read this passage from Psalms. And I go, Psalms? The Bible, 365 parts. So basically, if it's during the recant decision, we're a good 300-plus days in. You better be in the New Testament if you're going to be finishing the book on time. So I'm sitting there going, either he's not keeping a very good pace reading, or they're just trying to make a nice passage fit their little story. So that right there, this book was written probably about 2002, so there's been some embellishments about George Bush's reading for years now, and that just fits with it. Also, I don't know if when y'all looked at the portraits, I don't know if you noticed, but Laura Bush's portrait is very, very formal, almost too formal for someone, you know, serving and living in the late 20th and early 21st century. And it really doesn't fit. Did y'all see her picture as well?
I did. Mm-hmm. And I've got to disagree a little bit. I think the picture fit her better. Holding a book. This is the ex-librarian, okay, holding a book. Not only that, but literacy has been a big thing with her, promoting that. And another thing, at least they had her seated in one of her favorite places to sit in the White House and read.
Well, maybe you've answered
but that.
Maybe she reads two books a day, two books a week, and tells George about them.
And then he compare it to his picture, though. David, he's sitting there, no coat, no tie, and with that stupid smirk on his face. Oh,
that's fitting. Wendy, last word on the portraits.
I have to agree with you artistically. You know, Laura's her portrait could almost fit back, 200 years ago. I mean, there's nothing modern about it. So I guess you're right there. But and George, I mean, it's right that he has that stupid smirk on his face because, I mean, that's how we'll always remember him. So.
Yes. Well, but before we cut off the live show, listen to the weekly filibuster to hear Rick. I've forgotten his last name. I guess he's that forgettable. John McCain's campaign manager. Why am I forgetting
Davis.
His last name?
Davis.
Rick Davis.
How
he's
dare you forget his last name?
And so, yeah, well, I guess he's just not the Davis we keep up with. But I just noticed that, and I think that's good for Blog Talk Radio, that, you know, they're getting people of the caliber of a national campaign manager, even if it is on the other side. But I was just impressed by that and wanted to mention that. Also, we didn't get to the Alabama topics, but that just saves us something for next week. Maybe we'll try to have to get Mooncat to come on and discuss some of this. But, Wendy, we thank you for coming on, and we understand that you're going to be back in the state doing some big work, if you will. Can you say anything about it yet?
Well, no, but I'll let you have the scoop on it, David, when it's a little more public than it is now. But I'm delighted to be back home and looking forward to getting down to work here in Georgia.
Yeah, well, we'll look forward to hearing from you and keeping up to date. Thanks for coming on, though.
Thanks so much. Happy New Year, everybody.
Nice. Same to you. Good night.